Now on to a lighter topic this Friday. June is a peak month for gardening here in Minnesota, with its long sunny days and occasional rainstorms. Knowing that many of our listeners are going to be spending some of this weekend in their gardens, we've invited University of Minnesota horticulturist Julie Weisenhorn in to share her advice and answer your questions. Julie, welcome. It's great to have you back.
Good morning. Good morning.
And because our listeners always have lots of questions for you, I'm going to give out those phone numbers right away. If you have a question for Julie, give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000, or outside the metro area, you can call toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Or you can email us your question with talk@mprnews.org. Julie, we are due for some hot, hot weather this weekend.
Yes, definitely.
What tips do you have for folks on making sure their plants stay properly watered?
Well, one of the things to do is you could compost around your plants and watering the soil first so that it's saturated, and then putting that compost, or you could do mulch as well, either one. And that will help to hold in that moisture and also hold in the cooler temperatures in the soil. So that's one easy thing to do. And if people have already mulched, just water really well. Water early in the morning, that's a great time to do it. That helps the water to soak in and be available to the plant roots before any evaporation happens. Or you can water in the evening too, but the morning is best.
Is there a risk of being so afraid of drought that you overwater? I mean, how should you be gauging how much is enough?
Feeling the soil is one of the easiest things to do. So that means digging down a little bit around plants, maybe about 6 inches down. You can take a spade and just pop it into the soil, pull it back and feel that. And if it's moist down there or cool and damp, then you don't need to water. And to be on the lookout, too, that some plants will actually wilt in the heat, but it's not an indication that they don't have water. It's just from the high temperatures. And I think people will see quite a bit of that this weekend. They'll revitalize back as soon as the temperatures start to go down.
So if you see those wilting leaves, that doesn't necessarily mean get out the hose.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So just feeling that soil, and then those plants will pop right back up as the day wears on and the temperatures get cooler in the evening.
Now, we're talking about gardens today, but we'd be remiss in not mentioning trees, too. And I'm wondering about those boulevard trees, other trees. I mean, should people be worried about the health of the trees in their neighborhood?
Yeah, and actually with the mature trees, we oftentimes forget about watering those plants because they're so big and the canopy's far above our heads. But once you start to see wilt in mature trees, then you've got a serious problem on your hand. And drought is one of the biggest killers of trees, of mature trees. So it's important also to feel the soil around those trees. And you can do a drip soaker hose around there. Oftentimes, as people are watering lawns or watering other parts of their yard, the tree roots, which extend far beyond the canopy, are also absorbing water as well. So they're getting water too. New trees are a big concern because they need to be watered on a regular basis.
Is that your phone?
Yeah, sorry, I turned it off. Oh, geez. Sorry, everyone.
You might not know that Julie's actually in a rock band in the spare time when she's not a horticulturist. So I would think we just got
Arthur Alexander. I'm sorry about that. Boy, am I turning red right now?
No problem. So you're saying watering those younger trees is really important.
Right, because they're trying to establish their roots.
Yeah.
And we have two excellent publications on our extension site under the title of Water Wisely.
Mm-hmm.
And one is on watering, how much water does a newly planted tree need and how frequently should you water it? And then the second is on mature trees.
Okay.
And so there's some tips for how you can determine by the size of the girth of your tree or how far the roots extend and then how much water you need to be giving it.
We're talking this hour with Julie Weisenhorn, a horticulturist with University of Minnesota, and taking your gardening questions. If you've got some concerns of what's going on in your garden, give us a call with your question or comment. You can reach us at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. Again, that's 1-800-242-2828. 2828. Let's go to the phones. We've got Michael on the line in St. Peter. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm hoping you can solve for me the mystery of the enormous city and airport hanging petunia baskets. Every year we buy a hanging basket. Every year we barely can keep it alive. I give it 90 seconds, roughly 5 gallons of water a day, which was what I was instructed to do. And I drive around and I see by the end of the summer, the airport baskets are the size.
Yeah, they're huge.
I don't even know the size of cars hanging in the sky. And mine is just
orbs, giant orbs.
So
what do they know that we don't know, Julie?
Well, they have an irrigation system that's hooked up, so that those plants are getting water, which is great that you're watering your baskets too. They're also very, very large baskets. And one of the problems with any container is that it needs to be as big as possible.
Because of the root system?
Yeah, because of the root system, and also to have enough soil, and then also not to dry out as fast too, and not to succumb to the heat as well. So I don't know exactly their process, but I'm kind of figuring that they have irrigation that's dripping constantly, and then they're also doing a lot of fertilizing, and those containers that those plants are in are enormous.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got, you know, gardeners who are tending those on a regular basis. And it is a challenge with containers for homeowners to keep them watered and keep them healthy and have big enough containers.
So maybe Michael just needs a bigger container.
Yeah,
go big or go home.
Bigger, exactly.
You know, back to the heat we're dealing with this weekend. What are the most heat tolerant plants that you can put in your yard so that they don't necessarily suffer when we come to these times of year?
Well, it all starts with planting them correctly and choosing plants that are proper for your soil type. And I think sometimes we also plant during very hot times, and you should really be thinking about planting earlier in the season. We had kind of a wacky spring going back and forth, but preparing the soil properly for good drainage, and then also choosing plants properly, choosing the plants that are the healthiest with the biggest root systems is a great idea. And watering them well and keeping them healthy as they go into this warmer temperature. So it kind of starts with choosing the plants for the location.
Does that mean going native in terms of your plant selection?
Sometimes, but I wouldn't just restrict it to totally native plants. Native plants have evolved for our conditions and can tolerate, you know, the very cold winters and the very dry, hot summers that we have. But also some cultivars are pretty darn good, too. They're disease resistant, a lot of them. And they've also been, we call them nativars, where they're cultivars from a native plant. So they've taken some of the great features of that plant and they've bred a plant that has other features too. Maybe it's a grass that stands more upright versus one that flops.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Brian on the line from Cottage Grove. Brian, welcome. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. Good morning.
You may have heard, but recently we got a watering ban in place, and the entire city is kind of scrambling with some concerns about how to take care of our plants and our mature bushes and trees in the situation of a watering ban.
Yeah, so mulching is going to be a great thing to do. And mulch has we kind of go back and forth about that because mulch is not necessarily beneficial for ground nesting bees and important pollinators.
Mm, yeah.
And so people are kind of saying, oh, say no to mulch. But really, when it comes down to it, you just have to make a decision as to where you're mulching and what the value of the plants are that you're mulching. But that's one of the best things to do. As far as the watering ban goes, yeah, that's a tough situation. But doing things like mulching, and then if you do have those days that you can water, to water early in the morning, you can even turn your like a soaker hose, a drip hose on a timer. You can buy an inexpensive timer, put that on at 4 a.m. and then have that going, you know, when you wake up, have your coffee and have it shut off automatically. So there's even apps that can run irrigation systems now.
I think if I remember correctly, it's actually illegal to have a gray water reuse system installed in your house. But is that an option, say, using your old dishwater to go out and water the plants?
Yeah, the dishwater is a little sensitive because of the soap. Okay. But certainly if you boil vegetables, for example, you could cool that water and dump that on your plants. If you're canning, that's got a little salt in it maybe, but if you're using any large amounts of water like that, you could cool it down or take it out, and as long as it hasn't got any detergents or anything in it. So I don't know if I'd use my soapy water, that's
okay.
For sure.
Okay, good to know. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Brittany on the line in Hudson. Brittany, welcome.
Good morning. Hi, thank you. Mm-hmm. Good morning. So I have two questions. My first one is, watering like my shrubs and bushes, how often in between days, on regular like summer days, would it be good to water all of those?
Well, it will depend on whether it's an established shrub or a newly planted shrub. And I would recommend taking a look at those two extension publications. There's some easy to follow charts, and it depends on the size of the plant and then the type of plant. Also, some require more water than others. And then I would take a look at that, and that gives you great guidance. Plus, it gives you a lot of good background in the plant material as well.
And Brittany, you said you had a second question?
I do. I had planted what I think was a hydrangea.
Sure.
And the last couple of summers, it's only been producing leaves. So I'm wondering if there's anything in particular I could do so that we'll start producing flowers.
Well, do you know the type of hydrangea you planted?
Not really.
Okay. Probably because it may not be in full sun. It may be a situation where it's a pruning, where you may be pruning it at the wrong time of the year, or it might also need some improvement to the soil to add nutrients to the soil.
So would like an all-purpose plant, or what do you call it?
A fertilizer?
Yeah.
I have a
liquid all-purpose plant solution.
Okay, that would be helpful, but I'd suggest getting a soil test done for that area and also finding that label that you had with that hydrangea so that you could determine what cultivar. That has something to do with why it may not be blooming.
Okay. I'm almost certain it's an endless summer. Yeah. I think that sounds right.
Okay.
Yep. There's a great publication on that on the Bailey Nurseries website who released that plant. So Bailey Nurseries would be a good one to resource.
Thanks for your call, Brittany. For those who maybe weren't quite on the ball this spring getting their annuals in, what can folks plant now?
You can still be planting. Definitely plant early in the morning, especially if you're doing it this weekend. And be sure to water well and then mulch those plants so that you can hold that water in and keep those plants as stress-free as possible. Tomorrow's supposed to be very windy. Mm-hmm. Windy, hot weather is the worst time to plant. So
don't do that planting this
weekend. Yeah, maybe just hold off a little bit. If you have bought your annuals or bought your perennials and you're concerned about them drying out or something, then I would keep them in a shady, cool location. Keep them watered well. Even if they're full sun plants, keep them cool until you can get them in the ground so that those root balls don't dry out.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ben on the line in Mankato. Ben, hey there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
My question is regarding those plants that with like full sun for X amount of days or partial sun for like 4 to 6 hours. Are there any electronic devices or anything you can just buy and like stick in the ground and automatically measure to say like what that area is, like what type of plants are good for that?
Oh, I see. Okay.
Like a sunlight measurer?
Yeah, like a light meter that measures the amount of time. Well, light is dependent upon your quality of light is important as the length of light. So eastern light, morning sunlight, is cooler. You still get the full sun benefit versus western or afternoon sun. Which is more intense and hotter. So you want to know that when you're choosing plants for your two sides of your house or parts of your yard. I don't know of a product that you can put out there to measure the amount of light over a period of time. I usually recommend you pull up a lawn chair and get a cold drink and a book or your phone or something, and you just watch your light and you just kind of map it out on a graph paper or something so that you know what parts of your yard are, have full sun versus part sun or part shade.
Okay. We're talking this hour with Julie Weisenhorn. She's a horticulturist with the University of Minnesota and is taking your gardening calls. You can give us a call with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jack on the line in St. Paul. Jack, hey there.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Morning.
I have two eastern redbud trees, and they're the Minnesota strain.
Sure.
And I planted them about 15 or 16 years ago, and they've both been super healthy until last summer. One of them got a disease. I think it's verticillium. I'm not sure. But it got a lot of blotchy spots on the leaves, and so I pruned it back. And then this spring, and watered it like crazy last summer.
Right.
Then this spring, it had a fair amount of dead branches. And so I didn't want to prune it while it was blooming and while the leaves were coming out. But now the leaves are out. They're much smaller than usual. But I still want to get that dead wood off. And I'm wondering if it's too hot to be doing that or whether I should just go right at it no matter what the heat is like.
Yeah, if you can wait, and as long as that wood isn't diseased or oozing anything or hazardous, I would wait until you get some cooler weather. And just to that would just lessen some of the shock to the tree. But that'd probably be it sounds like you've done everything you can for those trees. If you do have a disease issue, we have a great the Plant Disease Clinic at the University of Minnesota is a great place to send a sample. It's a little pricey. It's about $45. But if they're mature trees like that, that mean a lot to you, it's well worth it to find out if there is an issue like verticillium wilt or something.
A colleague of mine says her rose bushes have been great. I think she planted them about 5 years ago. First 4 years, really bushy, covered in blooms. But this year, about half of the greenery has shown up. It looks kind of tired and spindly, not as many blooms. She wants to know what the problem might be. Does she need to feed the roses?
Well, we've had a lot of Japanese beetle damage over the years. It may have depleted some of the issues with her, you know, some of the health in her roses. It's good to look at the root system, if possible, is to feel down there. It might be, you know, might be appropriate to feed the roses. But it could also be we had a really tough winter on those roses. We didn't have much snow cover. And after 5 years, there may have been stresses each year that have kind of accumulated now. And now in the fifth year, the plants are just not performing very well. So sometimes when they get to be like that, you just have to make a call whether, you know, it's time to replace them or if you want to keep trying to make them, get them healthier. I would feel down by those roots area and see how dry it is, if it's compacted. And then make a decision about whether it's a good plant to keep in a prominent part of your yard or not.
Mm.
Sometimes plants just die. You know, it's just we don't really know why all the time, but sometimes that's the end of their life.
I also heard the term rose canker for the first time this spring.
Sure.
What is it and how do you treat it?
Well, rose canker, I'm not a pathologist. That's a good question for our pathologist, Michelle Grabowski. But rose canker is a bacterial issue that causes kind of a damage or a call it a wound or an opening in the stem of the rose bush. And it opens it to all sorts of other issues, too. But it can actually interfere with the transportation or the transport of nutrients throughout the plant. And that can cause dieback and cause half of your shrub rows to die. And so if you do have that issue or that question, you can either send in a sample or send in a photo to the Plant Disease Clinic. You can also ask Extension and send photos. And Master Gardeners and me will field those calls or field those emails.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jim on the line in Bloomington. Jim, good morning.
Hi. Actually, my name is Kim.
Oh, Tim.
But,
sorry.
I have pine trees in my yard, and it looks like they're getting black mold.
Okay.
They're dying, like, from the bottom up, and there's, like, clumps of, like, black, almost powdery stuff on them.
Okay.
And my question is there any way to save them or is it just too late? I just need to cut them down and start over.
I think when you have a mature tree issue like that, the best thing to do is contact a certified arborist. And the International Society of Arboriculture, ISA.org, I believe it is a great resource. You can put in your zip code and get a list of certified arborists within your area. Mature trees do a lot for our landscapes. They cool our landscapes. They create better energy efficiency in our homes. They look beautiful. They add property value. And so when you do see issues with them, I think you got to get the pro in to come to your property and assess it properly. So that would be my recommendation, is contact that certified arborist. On our extension website, under our trees and shrubs section, we actually have a publication about how to hire a certified arborist, and it gives you some good questions to ask, as well as some guidance for how to find one. So I would recommend going to that publication and using that as kind of a primer for hiring a certified arborist. Mm. Sometimes cities have them too.
Back to the phones. We've got Steve in St. Paul. Steve, hey there.
Good morning. How are you all doing?
Good. You?
Good.
I'm doing good. My question is this. I've got a hosta plant that has been in the ground for 20-plus years, and this spring it has developed some kind of a red to yellow dot that keeps growing and keeps spreading from leaf to leaf, and I don't know what to do with it. Should I just pull the thing out and get rid of it? Or is there some kind of a treatment I can have to put on the leaf to get rid of the whatever it is?
All right, Steve. Julie's looking pretty puzzled here.
So are they red spots or yellow spots?
It's a combination of both. They're kind of red. Some are red, some are yellow. Some have gotten pretty big. Some are very small. Somebody told me it was some kind of a bug that was eating the plant. I have no idea.
Hmm. Well, there's a virus called Hostavirus X that can harm and basically kill hostas.
Deadly, yeah. Hostavirus X.
But I think that's more of a streaky look to it. Here's what I would do is take a photo of it and then go to our extension site and go to Ask Extension and send it on in to us, and we'll see if we can figure out what it is, or we can contact, you know, we can do a little bit of research. If we don't know, again, that's a good thing to send in a sample to the plant disease clinic and have them take a look at that.
Okay.
It's hard to diagnose it on the radio, but go ahead and do that. It's Ask Extension. You just go to the site, Extension Garden site, scroll on down. It's extension.umn.edu. Click on Garden, go to the bottom.
Jo Marie writes, she called in, and she has an answer to that question about the earlier hydrangea issue.
Sure.
She says they either bloom on old wood or new wood. If it's the type that grows on new wood, you have to cut it down significantly each spring.
Yeah, and Endless Summer was touted as blooming on both old and new wood. So that's one of its great features initially, but we found that I think our winters are a little tougher on it. And it just can't do it. But yes, she's correct. Does it bloom on old or new wood?
Way from Woodbury writes, I have bugs that are eating all my plants from marigolds to watermelons. Mm. I've tried watering less and pesticides, but no use. What can I do?
Well, you have to identify the bug first. That's most critical. Anytime there's a problem, whether it's a disease or an insect issue or a plant issue, you got to identify the plant. You got to try to find that bug that's eating those holes. And if there's a disease problem, you need to get a sample of that in, and you need to find out what it is before you spray. I'm always worried when I hear people say, I've tried pesticides, but you may be dealing with a mite and you need a miticide. You might have, you know, this might be an adult beetle that's feeding, and it doesn't help to spray it because it flies off as soon as you start spraying it. Mm-hmm. So you really need to find out what the problem is and what the actual pest is before you treat it. The same goes for weeds as well. You need to ID those, because it's really going to be very dependent upon what you choose to do about it. Sometimes there's nothing to do about it. Sometimes you just kind of live with it. Sometimes it's cosmetic damage. It's not really fatal to the plant. We just don't like the way it looks. But that's part of gardening.
Mm. And also, we had a question from Sharon who wrote, I know the bee population is in trouble. Which flowers should I plant to help them?
Oh, Sharon, that's a great question. We could have a whole show on that.
Unfortunately, we only have a minute or so.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Okay. Well, we actually just released a new page called Flowers for Pollinators. It's been a big, big topic, as you all know, for all of us as gardeners and horticulturists. And it's called Flowers for Pollinators. It's on the Extension Garden website. Tons of resources, plant lists. And we've got some studies going on about annual flowers. And then we also are studying, of course, you know, native plants and ways to create habitat. So take a look at that Flowers for Pollinators site on the Extension Garden page.
Okay. And one last question. This is my question. We have a big bee and butterfly boulevard garden, but not most of the plants that we have bloom kind of late. Is there something we can choose that will bloom early that's a native that's good for pollinators?
Yeah, take a look at the Plants for Minnesota Bees publication on that same Flowers for Pollinators. It's from our bee squad. And the nice thing about that is it shows early to late blooming flowers. It's a one-page list. It's definitely a starter list, but it gives you some great ideas for getting that continual bloom from early season all the way through. Bulbs are great, too.
Okay.
Planting those in the fall.
Julie, thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. It's been great to be here, Marianne. Thanks a lot.
We've been talking to University of Minnesota horticulturist Julie Weisenhorn. If you're interested in gardening but don't have the space, a community garden plot might be what you're looking for. Community gardens have thrived in the Twin Cities over the past several years, converting empty lots into bountiful vegetable and flower gardens. In 2009, there were approximately 166 community gardens in the metro area. By 2016, that number had more than tripled to nearly 600. That's according to a tally kept by Minneapolis-based nonprofit Gardening Matters, which helps people to find or create their own community gardens. Joining me now from Gardening Matters is Board Chair Seth Kohlstennis. Seth, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
So first I should note, Gardening Matters is currently in hibernation. Seth, what exactly is going on?
That's correct. Back near the end of last year in December of 2016, we had to make the difficult decision to lay off the staff that we had due to financial constraints for the organization at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Since December, we've been in a period of hibernation, so exploring past funders and what are our strengths, what are our weaknesses. We brought in some professionals to do that, both folks that were outside of the organization and then also a former executive director. And right now we like to phrase it as we're in a time of germination. So we've moved from this hibernation state to germination, and we're looking at developing a new business model, and a new business plan, to go out to, former and potentially new funders, in the next, few months for sure.
Okay. So you've served as a resource for community gardens and people looking to create their community gardens. How is the fact that you're currently in this sort of hibernation, germination phase going to affect them?
Yeah, it's definitely been a challenge for folks with the absence of Gardening Matters in hopefully the short term again. A lot of folks have self-organized, folks on the north side of Minneapolis, folks in south side of Minneapolis, and folks over here in St. Paul, primarily in the Frogtown area. They've self-organized and having seed swaps and plant swaps and doing different classes and education on a very neighborhood-based level in our absence.
Mm.
And we partner with them in some ways.
So the fact that you have been struggling as an organization, is that a reflection of what's going on in the community garden movement right now, or is that something separate?
I don't think so. I really don't think that. Clearly, as you let off the little segment, community garden has grown exponentially in the last, for sure, the last 10 years, but more so probably the last 5 or 7 years. We're over 700 community gardens in the state now. From 200 when Gardening Matters started in 2008. So the growth is there, and it's still keeping going. People are still demanding space to grow in. That's not the problem. That's not the issue. I think more largely it's foundation funding has changed. That environment has changed to not so much funding community building efforts as workforce development and things like that. So it's been a challenge to navigate that arena.
So why advocate for community gardens? What's their importance to a neighborhood?
Yeah. They serve so many benefits to a community, from a health aspect, as we face climate change and combating that and limiting the food miles that our food travels, from a crime aspect and safety and community building again, the benefits are numerous.
And if somebody is interested in maybe joining a community garden, what would you say to them? Who is a good or the perfect candidate for joining a community garden?
Sure. A good place to start would be, though we're in a term, a mode of germination right now, we still have a lot of things on our website and tools that people can utilize there. So I would encourage people to go to gardeningmatters.org. And they, from there, you can find a map of community gardens across the state of Minnesota. That map is not entirely comprehensive. It doesn't have everyone in there or contact information for those gardens necessarily. But that's a good place to start if you wanted to find one in your neighborhood to join. Or you can also self-organize. And, you know, there's resources also on our website for starting up a community garden on your own. There are spaces throughout to do that.
Who do you typically see being a member of a community garden? Are these just people who live in apartments, or do they have their own yards but they don't want to put vegetable plots in their yards? I mean, who describe for me the typical, the sort of the people you see in a community garden environment.
It can vary quite a bit depending on the size of the garden and where it is. Some of them are smaller units, like a garden in a box or something like that, that's in a large high-rise apartment building that serves, you know, 6 to 12 people within that high rise. There can also be, you know, city-owned lots that a lot of neighbors in the area come together and are part of a community garden. So it's really the makeup of the neighborhood or the building it serves.
Are there people who you would say maybe community gardening is not for you, like somebody who thinks, oh yeah, this is going to be great, but that the fact that it's not in their backyard, they sort of abandon it after a couple of months?
Sure. So yes, community garden isn't for everyone. It is certainly a challenge. And while Gardening Matters does work on community gardens largely, we also support backyard gardeners and provide resources for them as well. We have a listserv called ComGar that people can tap into. That's through eDemocracy, and people can get a lot of information and knowledge from there and exchange of ideas with other gardeners across the state.
That sounds like one great resource. What other resources are available to people who want to start their own community gardens?
Again, I would direct folks to our website. We have a startup guide there, gardeningmatters.org. And that startup guide will go everything from, you know, acquiring space, if that's what you need, to setting, you know, to recruiting folks to organize it, to setting it up, to soil testing and health, to water access. That's a large obstacle for folks. Insurance is another obstacle. Our website has a lot of information on those.
Yeah, and that's an informational resource. I'm wondering, are there financial resources available, or say, you know, like if you wanted to get seeds or plants donated, are there ways that you can get that sort of thing?
Yeah, so typically in the past, like I said, Gardening Matters has done seed distributions and plant distributions, and we've had a membership model that people sign up for, and they get a certain. Unfortunately, we weren't able to do that this year with the circumstances that we're in. But like I said, a lot of folks have self-organized on the north side and the south side, and over in St. Paul, and they've done similar things where they've come together as a community and exchange seeds, and then they go home in their own homes and start plants. And then a few back in May, a number of communities had plant swaps from that, and so they exchanged plants. You know, somebody might have had, you know, way too many tomato plants, and they wanted, you know, a couple basil plants, and they would swap for those things.
Mm-hmm. We were talking earlier about the importance of having community gardens, what they offer for a community. Mm-hmm. How do you measure outcomes? The fact that we've seen the number of community gardens more than triple over a period of several years, does that translate to other changes in the neighborhood? Are you seeing greater resilience? How do you even measure that?
Sure. It's challenging to measure, if folks go to our website, we have a snapshot that we do every year of community gardening, and it kind of outlines the benefits that that they do. You know, for instance, 290 gardens in 2016 donated produce. We try measure through doing surveys of those community gardens. We also measure how much produce they grow. And over 106,000 pounds of produce was grown in those, at least ones that reported. That number is probably much higher, but there's definitely benefits of that. Like I said, there's benefits within the community and the safety aspect that that community gardens provide. And
Safety aspect. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Sure. Say there's an unused lot in a block, and folks start a community garden. It's a very center point for that. For that block or that neighborhood, it beautifies what was once maybe a blighted property. It provides beautification not only but also community building, it might be a property that potentially was a place for crime that happened perhaps in the past, or litter, or lots of different negative externalities.
Seth, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking with Seth Kuhl-Stennis. He's the board chair of Gardening Matters, a local nonprofit that works with community gardeners. You can find out more on their website, gardeningmatters.org.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.